And we want to welcome you to the History of Appalachia series, Part 2. So we'll be taking the midday artist spotlight to be able to catch up on our Appalachian series. Appalachia is a cultural region in the eastern United States that stretches from the southern tier of New York to northern Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia. While the Appalachian Mountains stretch from Belle Isle, Newfoundland, and Labrador in Canada to Chiaia Mountain in Alabama, the cultural region of Appalachia typically refers only to the central and southern portions of the range. As of 2010, the United States Census, the region was home to approximately 25 million people. Since its recognition as a distinctive region in the late 19th century, Appalachia has been a source of enduring myths and distortions regarding the isolation, temperament, and behavior of its inhabitants. Early 20th century writers often engaged in yellow journalism, focused on sensationalistic aspects of the region's culture, such as moonshining and clan feuding, and often portrayed the region's inhabitants as uneducated and prone to impulsive acts of violence. Sociological studies in the 1960s and 70s helped to re-examine and dispel these stereotypes. While endowed with abundant natural resources, Appalachia has long struggled and been associated with poverty. In the early 20th century, large-scale logging and coal mining firms brought wage-paying jobs and modern amenities to Appalachia, but by the 1960s, the region had failed to capitalize on any long-term benefits from those two industries. Beginning in the 1930s, the federal government sought to alleviate poverty in the Appalachian region with a series of New Deal initiatives, such as construction of dams to provide cheap electricity and the implementation of better farming practices. In 1965, the Appalachian Regional Commission was created to further alleviate poverty in the region, mainly by diversifying the region's economy and helping to provide better health care and educational opportunities to the region's inhabitants. By 1990, Appalachia had largely joined the economic mainstream, but still lagged behind the rest of the nation in most economic indicators. We welcome you once again to the history of the Appalachian people.
The culture of Appalachia is rooted in a love of story and song, and a deep devotion to family. These values were carried to the New World by immigrants from England, Ireland, Scotland, and Germany in the early 1700s. After the American Revolution, the tough, independent pioneers hoped to be left alone to work their rocky hillside farms. But their success in taming a forbidding wilderness would make it possible for others to exploit the great natural resources of the land. By 1800, exploration and growth were driving the newly United States of America. In Appalachia, rich valley planters wanted to increase their land holdings. They cared little for the needs of the small farmers, and even less for those of the native people of the Appalachian Mountains.
The day will soon come when you will unite yourselves with us, and we shall all be Americans. You will mix with us by marriage, Your blood will run in our veins and will spread with us over this great continent. Thomas Jefferson, 1808.
To define an ongoing relationship with the Indians, the new federal government had created what was called a civilization policy.
The idea was to obliterate Indian culture so that Indian people as individuals could be assimilated into the United States. One feature of the civilization policy was to turn Indians into farmers according to European notions of farming.
But to run bigger farms, the Cherokee needed more labor. Native people, who had once taken little notice of race, adopted the European practice of buying and selling African slaves.
Cherokees increasingly adopt many of the racial attitudes of Europeans. Not all Cherokees adopted these attitudes, but many Cherokees who had capital to invest began to invest in African American slaves.
In countless ways, the Cherokee were adjusting to life in a European culture.
The Cherokees, in the space of a single generation, became civilized, quote-unquote. They became literate. They developed an alphabet. They developed a government. They settled down like white men.
The Cherokee were an interest in people, many as civilized as their neighbors of the white race. Some were quite wealthy. Gardens and orchards were seen everywhere, and the women graceful, with, in many cases, added beauty. General Winfield Scott.
But the settled prosperity of the Cherokee people was not destined to last. In 1828, a tough Scotch-Irishman from the Carolina Hills was elected president. Andrew Jackson, known as Old Hickory, was a great frontiersman who had fought alongside the Cherokee against the Creeks. During the War of 1812, he had led a ragtag army from the mountains of Kentucky and Tennessee and defeated the British at the Battle of New Orleans. He was an Appalachian hero. By the time Jackson took office, many Cherokee in Appalachia were successful on their farms, but some whites had begun to resent their prosperity.
The whites said, "You know, if you behave more like us, we'd leave you alone." Well, they did, and we didn't leave them alone. Why didn't we leave them alone? Because we wanted their land.
When gold was found on Cherokee land in the hills of Georgia, there was no turning back. Old Hickory gave in to the political pressure in what many saw as a betrayal of his former Indian allies.
I'm afraid our forebears looked on these people as something less than human and something to be exterminated or to just be moved out of the way.
Jackson supported the removal of the Cherokee to the western prairies on what would become known as the Trail of Tears.
It is not a happy record. Andrew Jackson became the embodiment of it because, as the President of the United States, he could have reversed this. He could have stood for what we now regard as justice, but he was a man of that region and a man of the frontier, and he did not regard it as justice.
So in the fall of 1838, the Cherokees began to make their way to the west. It was a terrible experience. The winter was unusually cold. They waited for weeks to cross the Mississippi because of ice, because of snow. The suffering was almost unbelievable.
Some Cherokee took refuge in the North Carolina mountains, but most of the native people of Appalachia were forcibly taken from their ancient homeland and marched to what is now Oklahoma.
I wish I could forget it all. But the picture of 645 wagons lumbering over the frozen ground with their cargo of suffering humanity still lingers in my memory. Let the great judge of all the earth weigh our actions. Private John G. Burnett, 2nd Tennessee Volunteers.
Nearly 5,000 died on the wretched journey.
What did we do? How did we speak? How did we err this way? And who is to blame for the trail of tears we all have walked this day? Chief Tom Thunderhorse.
Two decades before the Civil War, the most populous and powerful Indian tribe had been nearly eliminated from the southern mountains. Andrew Jackson's government believed that moving the Indians west, far from the centers of power, would bring peace to the fast-growing eastern region. But by the 1850s, northern and southern states were roiling over social and economic differences and over the status of another non-white people.
In the 1860 census, there was only one county in all of Appalachia, no matter how you define it, that did not have any slaves.
Leased or rented slaves provided critical labor to the growing industries. The manufacture of salt in southwest Virginia and eastern Kentucky, and the iron industry, which was scattered throughout the region. The shape of the land defined the way slavery developed in the mountains.
Appalachian wasn't a place which needed large plantations, but most people in the region wanted to have at least one other person to help out. So slavery moved from plantation type of slavery to one of individuals, and families would work to have another hand.
Small farmers made their lives easier by exploiting free labor. For the ruling elite, it was an economic necessity. Slaves were also a symbol of social status.
We don't think of Appalachia as a society that had distinct classes, but it did. And the upper class was more and more identified with slavery, both politically and symbolically.
But the backwoodsmen did not have the same commitment to a society based on slavery.
The great majority of people in Appalachia wanted the tension between the North and South to go away. They didn't want to choose sides. In fact, there's a woman who said we were on the fence and we could see both sides of the great issue.
The turning point came in a small Appalachian town called Harper's Ferry at the meeting of the Potomac and the Shenandoah Rivers in western Virginia. It was there that the abolitionist John Brown and 21 men attacked the National Arsenal on October 16, 1859. Brown's plan was to steal weapons and start a slave insurrection in the South.
He expected that because slavery was not as important in the mountain regions, that the white people of the mountains would rally to his cause. Of course, the very opposite was true.
Brown was captured and hanged, and the abolitionists mourned his loss. Backwoods people of Appalachia were not among them.
John Brown was not a hero to people in Western Virginia. The attack on Harper's Ferry was viewed in very much the same light that we view the attack on the World Trade Center. It was unconscionable.
People in Appalachia were furious that their land would be the likely battleground for a North-South war. They resented the moralizing of the anti-slavery movement, and especially the arrogant single-mindedness of John Brown.
That's very difficult for anybody in the 21st century to sympathize with, because we can't really see a positive side to slavery. But in fact, a great many people did, not so much a positive side as an inevitability that they were stuck with it and they had to live with it.
A year and a half after Harper's Ferry, the nation was at war. The mountaineers were pulled in both directions. It is estimated that 150,000 men of Appalachia fought for the South, and 100,000 fought for the Union. In the mountains, it was civil war within your own family.
I thought the boy who shot me had a familiar face, but in the battle's fury, 'twas difficult to trace.
The standard cliches about the Civil War, brother against brother and so on, were far more true in the Appalachian Mountains, because it was neither quite north or south, and you could go down the valley farm by farm, and this one was Union, this one was Confederate, and this one was, you know, back and forth.
When the Virginia militia was called to state service, my great-grandfather marched off with his buddies and fought in the Army of Northern Virginia under General Lee. When his younger brother came of age, he crossed the mountains and enlisted in the Union Army. And my father remembered these two old men at dinner every Sunday, still fighting the Civil War.
I thought it was my brother J.F., him I could but see. I'd kiss him and forgive him and lay me down and die.
As my grandfather told me, that wasn't their war. That war, as he referred to it, they didn't own slaves. They certainly had no special love for the low country planter class there. But when the Confederates came through and conscripted all of the local men into the Confederate Army, they all joined together and marched over the ridge into Kentucky. In the middle of a battle, they all decided to desert, which was a very common thing during the war, and go back home. A couple weeks later, the Confederates came back through and captured all of the men from this little community and lined them up and shot them in front of their families. And from that day on, you can't find a Democrat in my original end of the county. They're all Republicans, because it was the Democrats who had created these atrocities during the war. And so for many, many years in the mountains, one voted the way one's ancestors had shot.
War sent the mountains into a lawless chaos. Deep hollers made great hideouts for deserters or Union prisoners escaping from Southern jails. Neither army could move large numbers of men across the craggy terrain, and fighting still looked like the days of the Indian Wars. Home Guard and guerrilla groups attacked any cabin loyal to the opposite side. It was a war of skirmishes, of ambushes, of people being shot in the back from the woods by the side of the road.
Those atrocities existed all up and down the ridge, communities fighting against each other and troops riding through on their way somewhere else, destroying crops and stealing cattle and hogs and sheep.
Beyond the mountains, army legions battled face to face. Along a creek called Antietam, not far from Harper's Ferry, One of the bloodiest confrontations of the war was waged on an open field. It was September 17th, 1862.
Where many's the soldier fell, is where occurred the story which now to you I'll tell.
Union forces prevailed, but more than 7,000 soldiers lost their lives.
The dead lay all around me, we all together lay, for we had had a fearful fight upon the field that day.
Among the dead and wounded were thousands of young men from the backwoods of Appalachia. The losses were deeply felt in the mountains, and the bitter residue of the war would linger for decades. Communities had been shattered, and people retreated into the family.
There's one theory that the Civil War accustomed people in Appalachia to using violence to settle personal grievances. There was two or three generations of extraordinary violence, extraordinary by both regional and national standards.
The war certainly left behind a climate of fear and mistrust, and people protected themselves as best they knew how.
There's a code in the mountains way down in the backwoods. There's a code in the mountains and an unwritten law. They're hairy.
Before the century turned, the most notorious family feud in American history would send images of violent, backward mountain men roaring across the newspaper headlines of America. The famous feud took place in the remote valley of the Tug River, which divided Kentucky from the newly formed state of West Virginia. On the West Virginia side of the river lived a family named Hatfield, across from a Kentucky family named McCoy.
The Hatfield-McCoy feud really wasn't a feud, it was simply a conflict. It had much more to do with the political and economic changes that were occurring in central Appalachia at that time than it had to do with the folk culture of the region or any of the traditional stories associated with it.
In the rest of America, industrialization was booming, and the hardwoods of the southern Appalachians were in great demand. Before large timber companies came into the Tug Valley, the wood was cut and marketed by local farmers, including the Hatfields and the McCoys. The family patriarchs were Randolph McCoy, known as Old Rannell, and Anderson Hatfield. Anderson Hatfield was a man born to star in his own drama. In the Civil War, he had led a group of Confederate guerrillas known as the Logan Wildcats. He was tall and imposing, with looks that earned him the nickname Devil Anse.
Devil Anse Hatfield was probably one of the most charismatic people, from what I can gather, that ever lived in this valley.
He was always described as, from childhood, as precocious. He did things like go out and get bear cubs and tame them and have them as domestic pets, and he was always known as the best shot in the valley.
Hatfield built the most successful timber business in the Tug Valley. McCoy was not as fortunate and bristled for years as his competitor thrived. Then in 1872, Devil Anse won a lawsuit over 5,000 acres of land that belonged to Rannell's cousin, Perry Klein. McCoy was outraged and concluded that Hatfield was a thief, even though the land had been legally won.
Randall, I think, was like a lot of people in the valley who were losing out, whose economic prospects were declining, and that made him bitter and unhappy and trying to find someone to blame. And he blamed the Hatfields.
Klein and the McCoys vowed revenge for the lawsuit. Resentments grew over everything from property to politics. But the outright battles began at an Election Day celebration in 1882 with an attack on Devil Anse's younger brother, Ellison.
Three McCoy brothers got drunk and picked a fight with Ellison Hatfield. They stabbed him. He was a very powerful man. They stabbed him several times. It didn't do any good, so they shot him in the back. And he lingered for 3 days.
Devil Anse said, well, if he dies, I'll kill the McCoy boys. And he kept him in a home over on the West Virginia side up in the hollow there. And they came to him and they said, he's dead. And then Devil Anse sent his people.
They caught them at daybreak way down in the backwoods. They caught them at daybreak.
They went over and they took the McCoy boys and they wrapped them around a pawpaw bush and they killed them.
They pleaded for mercy, but they heard not their plea.
In September of that year, the Kentucky court issued murder indictments for Devil Anse and 20 of his supporters. No arrests were actually made, and things calmed down for a while. But 5 years later, the feud exploded again.
So we have to wonder what happened in those 5 years. Well, what happened was the state of Kentucky discovered it had very rich coal resources in the Tug Valley, and it wanted to develop those resources.
The Norfolk and Western Railroad Company announced plans to run a line right through the Tug Valley. Suddenly, there were huge profits to be made in land, timber, and coal. McCoy's cousin, Perry Klein, was now a lawyer in Pikeville, Kentucky, and still furious over losing his land to Devil Anse. In 1887, he convinced the governor to enforce the old indictments against the Hatfields and to extradite them for trial in Kentucky. The politicians had joined the fray. This was warfare between Kentucky and West Virginia. The states were determined to protect their local families and hang on to valuable property. West Virginia refused to extradite. Taking matters into his own hands, Klein sent bounty hunters racing across the border. In response, a drunken Hatfield gang staged a vicious attack on a McCoy cabin.
They succeeded in burning down the house. They succeeded in killing two of Randall's adult children, and they beat up Aunt Sally McCoy, which was one of their worst mistakes because she was very much beloved.
I mean, coming down on those people in the middle of the night with kids inside and women and girls, and burn and kill.
This time, the Hatfields could not escape the law. Seven of them went to the Kentucky penitentiary. But somebody had to pay more dearly for the bloody attack, and that was Ellison Mounts, a nephew of Devil Anse.
Poor Ellison Mounts, who was probably retarded, he was known as dim-witted or slow in the valley, ended up being the scapegoat, you might say.
In February 1890, Ellison Mounts went to the scaffold. The feud was over. It had lasted more than a decade and had left 12 people dead.
There are some people that say, well, who won the feud? No one won the feud. The McCoys lost the most. But the Hatfields will be the first to tell you we didn't win. We didn't win anything.
There's a code in the mountains way down in the backwoods. A code in the mountains and an unwritten law. There's a code in the mountains way down in the backwoods. Code in the mountains is the only law there.
The conflict between the Hatfields and the McCoys played right into the hands of investors from the Northeast and Upper Midwest, who were now streaming into Appalachia.
One of the things that the industrialists were very concerned with was violence. And industrialists blame this on backward culture. You know, they blame this on these feral people, you know, who were naturally violent and so on, and prone to blood feuds.
Before the middle of the 1880s, newspapers, mostly when they talked about Appalachia, it was these people were a little backward. They were country bumpkins, but they were in a way romantic. But after the 1880s, when it became important to the state leaders in Kentucky and capitalists to invest and to build railroads, it made sense to say these people are obstructionists. They're violent. They're barbaric. They're savages. They kill people. They're in the way of civilization.
But modernization was coming to the Hollers, and the violence that marked its arrival would be part of mountain life for years to come. By the turn of the 20th century, land in Appalachia was at a premium. New rail lines were slashing through the mountains, bringing an end to the era of the first frontier.
That happened like a thunderstorm. The coming of the railroad into the Appalachian created a kind of hysteria. Land that you couldn't sell for a dollar and a quarter an acre one day, if you found out the next day that a railroad was passing right near it or through it, suddenly it was worth $15 an acre. People who were subsistence farmers were suddenly thinking in terms of incredible wealth.
But the mountaineer was not about to get rich. He was about to lose the great bounty that had first drawn his ancestors to this land.
The railroads weren't constructed to move people, to diversify the economy, to improve the quality of life of individuals. They were constructed for the sole purpose of extracting the raw materials.
The local family business could not survive when large companies joined forces with the railroads to carry away the giant poplars and towering white oaks.
They came to Appalachia in a way that ravaged the hillsides, that destroyed the small growth, polluted the rivers and streams, caused massive fires, and in less than one generation, one of the world's great resources of hardwood timber was clear-cut and stripped from the Appalachian region.
While the forests were still being cut, other speculators started digging beneath the land for coal, the precious black diamonds.
In parts of eastern Kentucky, primarily, companies very quickly came to realize that they didn't have to acquire the surface rights to the land, that they could sever the surface rights from the mineral rights and pay local farmers or local landowners a very small amount for the rights to those minerals.
You can keep the land. They pitched it at the people. You can keep your land. It's yours. Just sign this. What you owned actually was the skim on top, just that. And you had to pay taxes on that. And you had to keep the road up for the coal company. That was it. It's outrageous.
People would sell their mineral rights, thinking that that would be fun. There might be a mine nearby, but that they would be undisturbed, basically. They found out in a few years that that wasn't the case. People were basically kicked off their farms, and they had a choice of either leaving or moving into a coal camp and going into the mines.
Jobs in the timber and coal mines paid a decent wage, often more money than had ever been pulled from the farm. But ownership had moved from local hands to the control of outsiders. The relationship between the Appalachian and his land was changing. And so was the cultural makeup of the region.
This was a time period when many people came from Eastern Europe, Southern Europe, to work in the coal mines. My grandfather was from Sicily. There's a large Italian population in the southern part of West Virginia in the coal camps. Also, quite a few African Americans came in from the south to work in the mines. They were looking to get away from the sharecropping and the Jim Crow laws.
You had African Americans working alongside people whose ancestors had lived in Appalachia for over 100 years. The Anglo-American or Celtic American ancestors, the Appalachian whites, if you will.
The classic sort of morphology of the Appalachian coal town will have a black district, a native white district, and a foreign immigrant district.
But we know that blacks had the worst housing. The blacks had housing closest to the mines. And it usually was a stream and a bridge to separate black housing from white housing. This myth that I often heard when I first worked in the coal fields that once they got under the ground, they were all black. Well, that's hogwash.
The mine owners, in a very calculated way, encouraged racism, encouraged mistrust, you know, would spread rumors deliberately, you know, about what the niggers were doing or what the bohunks were doing or, you know, and so on and so on. Because if you kept them afraid of one another and at war with one another, they were less likely to unionize.
The coal companies gained enormous influence over politics and the law. The demand for coal was doubling every 8 to 9 years, and jobs were plentiful. But no matter where he'd come from, every miner in the camp lived in a company house, slept in a company bed, and ate food from the company store.
There was no safety. There was no money. Everything had to be spent in that coal camp or with that company. You were just like a donkey or a horse to them and worked back in the coal mines. You didn't like it? I guess that's where the expression, you can lump it, came from.
The company store was a double-edged sword. It was a place to gather. It was a place to sit around and see neighbors. And yet the company store also symbolized the lack of control that one had over one's life and the level of control that the company had. And in some minds, one was only paid in scrip that one had to use at the company store.
The company would issue you the scrip, and you would take that scrip and go into their store, and you could buy almost anything you wanted, even an automobile. They would order one for you. But over a period of time, the company was giving you a dollar in scrip for approximately 75 cents in money. That's what it amounted to.
If they'd strike or something and a company store would let you go ahead and get groceries, then you'd be in whole. Payday, sometimes you wouldn't draw no payday.
One payday, he come home, he was like $47 in the hole, you know, instead of drawing money. He still owed the coal company $47.
They were paid by the tonnage, which meant that the more coal they dug, the more they got paid, theoretically. But the company weighed the coal. So if you dug a ton of coal, they might not give you credit for a ton of coal. Because you were paid by the ton, you were better off if you had more family members working in the mine, and so men would take their sons down in the mines with them. In many cases, that was the only way a family could survive, to have several sons working in the mines.
Come home, you young fellas, so young and so fine, and seek not your fortune way down in the mine. It'll form.
America drew a rich bounty out of the mountains. It was drawn by men with bone-weary labor, 12 hours in the hole, where you could be crushed in an instant, or else die slowly from the black lung.
Daddy's knees was bleeding every night when he'd come home. And I asked Daddy one day, I said, Daddy, why does your knees bleed? And he told me that he worked in such low places that you couldn't stand up and he had to crawl.
where it's dark as a dungeon, damp as a dream.
All those old miners, you know, they eat a lot of dust. You'd see them coming outside of the evening after work, and you couldn't see nothing but their eyes and teeth. The dust is falling off of them everywhere.
Shines. It's dark as a dungeon way down in the mine.
Say, did you see him going? It was early this morning. He passed all these houses on his way to the coal. He was tall, he was slender, and his dark eyes so tender. His occupation was mining, West Virginia, his home.
My granddaddy never missed a day's work, and he rode horseback over the mountain 9 miles one way twice a day for 17 solid years. And I seen him go, and he's wrapped up in his old army overcoat. I can see him still today.
It was just before 12 I was feeding the children. Ben Mosley came running to bring us the news. Number 8 is all flooded, many men are in danger. And we don't know their number, but we fear they're all doomed.
I've been at the pit of a mine during an explosion, seeing the faces of the mothers and the sisters and the wives and the little children standing around waiting. It's a different breed. Coal miners.
So I picked up the baby and I left all the others to comfort each other and pray for our own. There's Timmy, 14, and there's John, not much younger. Their own time soon will be coming to go down the black hole.
When you have the whole family working in the mine, then when there's an explosion, every male in the family's wiped out. You had situations where women lost their husbands, their fathers, their brothers, and their sons all in the same explosion. If you got killed, if you got injured, your widow or your family was put out of the house. If you could no longer provide for your family, then they had to leave.
Now what can I say to his poor little children? Or what can I tell his old mother at home? Or what can I say to my heart that's clear broken? To my heart that's clear broken if my darling is gone.
Dangerous as it was, the work did not bring great rewards. To be competitive, companies paid low wages with few benefits. Although labor unions were growing across America, the old mountaineer was proud to be a miner and held tight to his independence. But the coal company now controlled his life. The pressure had to break. West Virginia, which had suffered more deadly mining accidents than any other state, would also be home to some of the bloodiest battles. In the freezing winter of 1912, the first of the great coal wars broke out at Paint Creek and Cabin Creek.
This is a strike for recognition of the Union. Men walked out and then got locked out, and so you have a major strike involving tens of thousands of people.
Cabin Creek, Paint Creek strike was a good example of local people just saying, you know, I'm not going to take this anymore. I'm not going to put up with the way I'm being treated.
The owners would stop at nothing to keep the union out. They brought in their own muscle to intimidate the miners. Hired guns from the Baldwin Felts Detective Agency.
Many of them are convicted felons, people who are not afraid of violence, people who could thrive on violence and earn a living at it.
As soon as the miners went on strike, they were evicted from their homes by the guards. Hundreds of families were reduced to living in tents, where they survived wretched conditions for nearly a year. The hills echoed constantly with gunfire as the miners kept trying to drive out the guards with sniper attacks. In the midst of the struggle, there was one person who offered hope, a charismatic organizer for the United Mine Workers called Mother Jones.
Mother Jones claimed West Virginia miners as her boys. She was a darling of all coal miners. The miner's angel, they called her.
She was like a Victorian grandmother from hell. Boy, could she could cuss a storm.
Mother Jones did not mince words. She stood on the steps of the state capitol and boomed, "I warn this little governor that unless he rids Paint Creek and Cabin Creek of these goddamn Baldwin Felts mine guard thugs, there is going to be one hell of a lot of bloodletting in these hills." Miners and guards kept up the attacks. Twice, the little governor brought in the state militia. A year after the strike began, on a cold day in February, the Bull Moose Special thundered into the strike zone. The Special was a steel-plated train that was used to transport scab workers up to the mines. But this time, it had sheriff's deputies and mine guards on board, carrying machine guns and high-powered rifles. Sleeping families awoke to the sound of bullets ripping through their tents.
The miners also got a hold of guns and shot back, so you had some pitched battles. It's amazing that only one person was killed, partly because the miners had dug out the bottoms of their tents and were sleeping below ground level because they'd been shot at before.
Even this desperate effort did not stop the war at Paint Creek. The violence only got worse. It was hard to imagine how it would all end. In the spring, West Virginia inaugurated a new governor, Henry Hatfield, a nephew of Devil Anse. Henry Hatfield was young, educated, and committed to reform.
He was also a doctor, so he actually took his medical bag up the day after he was inaugurated, went to the tent colonies and treated people who were sick, treated the children and so forth, as a gesture to say he was sympathetic to what was going on. When he got back to Charleston, one of the local coal operators confronted him about this, criticizing him for going and helping the miners. And apparently there was a confrontation in the governor's office at the state capitol, and Governor Hatfield punched him out.
The new governor was determined to settle the debilitating strike. He appealed to the owners, the miners, and to Mother Jones.
He envisioned himself as a guy in the middle, and he would be fair to both sides. The problem is, of course, that both sides were not equal, and when his patience ran out and he wanted the strike stopped, he simply leaned very heavily on the miners.
The strikers gained some concessions, but not the one they really wanted, the right to unionize. Mother Jones kept the story in the newspapers until the Senate set up a committee to investigate. But the miners had been forced back to work, and Henry Hatfield could claim that he finally put an end to the war at Cabin Creek. For the next few years, there was peace in the coal fields, while war raged in Europe. Those who stayed in the hills made a good living, digging record tons of coal to fuel the war. When the soldiers returned, old tensions were quickly rekindled. War had left the country in a recession, and wages were lowered in the southern coal fields. Thousands of miners were added to the rolls of the United Mine Workers of America. In alliance with local politicians, the coal companies employed every tactic to stop the union. In May 1920, Baldwin Felt's detectives arrived in the deep mountain town of Matewan in Mingo County, West Virginia, and started evicting union families from their homes. On a drizzly spring day, the coal war started up again. This time, another member of the Hatfield clan would take center stage. 28-year-old Smilin' Sid Hatfield was the police chief at Matewan, and he sided with the miners. Hatfield pulled together a gang, headed for the railway station, and took on a dozen of the Baldwin Felt's guards. Ten people died in the Matewan massacre. Seven guards, two miners, and the mayor of the town.
They just took so much, and then all at once one day, they lined up toe-to-toe, nose-to-nose. And I think if you're looking for eye for an eye, the miners kindly got even that day.
But the sense of triumph didn't last. A year later, the Baldwin Felt's guards got their revenge when they ambushed Sid Hatfield and murdered him in cold blood. The guard who did the shooting was never convicted of the crime. Sid was now a martyr for coal miners. His murder inspired the legendary march on Blair Mountain, when 15,000 miners descended on Mingo County. But the coal operators were armed and ready. For 3 days, gunfire echoed off the mountain. The governor appealed to Washington, and 2,000 federal troops came in to put down the miners. It was the only time in U.S. history when the government decided to drop bombs on its own people.
This was 1921, after World War I, when you had the first military use of airplanes. A squadron was preparing the next day to fly over the miners and drop bombs on them. But they ran into fog on their way, and one of the planes crashed and the pilot was killed.
It can be made into a comedy of errors now, and it looks like a farce. But at the time, you know, they were real bullets.
This was not something that happened undercover. This was banner headlines in the New York Times, you know, this insurrection in West Virginia. Martial law declared, the U.S. Army sends troops in. It was really one of the major labor struggles of the early part of the 20th century.
The miners could not fight the federal government. Most of these men were World War I veterans and couldn't bear the idea of firing against the same uniform they had worn not so many years before. The defeat of the miners at Blair Mountain broke the Union in West Virginia.
It certainly dramatized the plight of the miners, and it won sympathizers around the country, but that was a sort of empty victory.
Which side are you on?
Although it would be another decade before all the miners won the right to unionize, The long, hard years of the coal wars had taught the Appalachian people how to work together in a fight for their very survival.
Next time on the Appalachians. In the 20th century, all of America comes to love the music of the mountains. Appalachian people struggle through the Great Depression and two world wars, and many are forced to move to big cities to find work. But love of land, family, and music holds the culture together and points toward a better tomorrow.
Order a copy of this program or other companion materials, please visit www.wnpt.net/Appalachians.
In the deep dark hills of eastern Kentucky, that's the place where I trace my bloodline. And it's there I read on a hillside gravestone, said you will never leave Harlan alive. Well, my granddad's dead walked down Catterns Mountain, and he asked Tilly Hilton be his bride. Said, won't you walk with me out of the mouth of this holler, or we'll never leave Harlan alive. Where the sun comes up about 10 in the morning, and the sun goes down about 3 in the day, and you fill your cup with whatever bitter brew you're drinking, and you spend your life just thinking of how to get away. No one ever knew there was coal in the mountains till a man from the northeast arrived. He said, I'll pay you for your minerals. But he never left Harlan alive. Well, Granny, she sold out cheap, and they moved out west of Pineville to a farm where big rich land. And they laughed and sang a new song. Bruce said we'd never leave Harlan alive. Times got hard, and tobacco wasn't selling, and old granddad knew what he'd do to survive. He went and dug for Harlan coal, and he sent the money back to Granny.
but he never left Harlan alive. Where the sun comes up about 10 in the morning, and the sun goes down about 3 in the day, and you fill your cup with whatever bitter brew you're drinking, and you spend your life digging coal from the bottom of your grave. And the sun comes up about 10 in the morning, and the sun goes down, down, down about 3 in the day, and you fill your, go on and fill it up with water.
Thank you for listening to part two of the history of the Appalachian people.